Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay, your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Broadview Mortgage, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates, and a wide array of loan programs. And Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
It's great seeing you. How was your week?
My weekend was terrific.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, as I said last week, weekends sometimes are problematical because I'm retired, so I enjoy the freedom of no traffic. And weekends, there are more people enjoying themselves, which is.
This is a deja vu moment. We've had this airing on the air before.
Right, this show is a repeat. So, the first article we have is. Ask the question is a headline. It's in the Wall Street Journal. It says, do you suffer from narrow framing? Do you suffer from narrow framing? And what the theme of this article is that, it was first thought about by Paul Samuelson, the Nobel Prize winning economist at MIT. And here are the questions that were posed to people that made that are the best way to explain narrow framing. Would you accept a bet in which you win $200 if the coin lands on heads or lose $100 if it lands on tails? And Professor Samuelson rejected the bet, and other members of the economics department rejected that bet. And then they asked the question again and said, what if we did the same bet did it twice? Do you want to do it? We'll do the bet twice. In other words, we'll flip it two times.
So meaning the odds out of it happening twice?
And the acceptance rate dropped 23% even lower in terms of the number of people that wanted to take the bet. And Richard Thaler, who's a behavioral economist, said that it's sort of like if you want to play the same bad bet twice, it's like having an extra large portion of food that you don't like, and of course
and
you're not going to eat it.
Asking for seconds.
Asking for seconds. So then they said, okay, let's try something else. Let's say that you have a 25% chance of winning $400, a 50% chance of winning $100, and a 25% chance of losing $200. Would you accept the bet? And most people found this more appealing, even though the expected value of both bets is exactly the same. And they asked why. And they said, because in the first instance, there is this explicit 50% chance of losing, whereas with the other bet where there's four opportunities, there is a less fixation on the 50% chance of losing money. So it's this question of how you frame a problem sometimes influences how you make your investment decision.
Well, and you know, you can translate that right into the election, the polling on this last election that was so different from the polls were so different from the outcome, and a lot of it had to do with the framing of the questions. You know, if you do any market analysis, the framing of the question really dictates a lot of the times what the answers are going to be. And so if you ask a question in only one way, people's response is different and oftentimes not even accurate of what they're thinking.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a whole group of political theorists and actual practitioners that use push polling, where how they ask the question influences how they'll vote because they push them. So, for example, you'd say about Mr. Smith running for local office. Are you concerned if Mr. Smith had been convicted of child pornography?
Right. Okay. Yeah. No, I've gotten some of those polls actually, interestingly enough, at the local level.
Yeah.
you know, where they the questions are so damning whether the person did it or not is it insinuates that they did.
Right. It's not really a poll. It's just they call everybody to get them to focus on a negative that doesn't exist.
Correct.
So the next article is about investment advisors, which I guess is one of your favorite subjects, about what value do investment advisors have? And the reason this was in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, and what caused this writer to write about this was that, and we've talked about this before, that the average mutual fund has done much better than the average mutual fund investor consistently. And what this study found was that one of the real benefits of a financial advisor is it causes people to not be as precipitous. So if you don't have a financial advisor and the market's crashing, you get emotional and say, I have to sell. One of the good things about a financial advisor is that they provide you with some degree of objectivity and emotional stability.
Absolutely. And a great example is the 2008 crisis.
Which is what they use in the article.
Right. And, you know, the 2008 crisis was a difficult time at best for people who had money invested in the market and even those people who didn't. And to have somebody to call to really bounce ideas off of and have a better understanding of what's going on in the market, I think is invaluable.
You know, one of the other points he made about being having a, as he calls it, the human element, because again, when you're making decisions on your own, sometimes you become emotional, is that the investment advisor helps you do not just stock and bond advice, but helps you organize your finances, prioritize your goals. I mean, so many investors don't have a goal.
Right. There's a distinction between a financial advisor and a certified financial planner. So a certified financial planner is someone who's actually looking at your overall picture, not just your return on a monthly, quarterly, annual basis of XYZ mutual fund or Apple stock. They're trying to make sure that you as a client have the most chips at the end of the game. You know, if you think about it in terms of professionals that people hire, you have the CPA whose sole purpose is to limit how much taxes you're paying. You have the attorney who's looking at liability and how to make sure that your overall being is protected from liability. Then you have the financial advisor. And we often say at Arlington that we're here to make sure that you have the most chips at the end of the game.
And, you know, the other thing I find that is a benefit of having a financial advisor is that I know people who invest because they think they have to invest and they think that investing is about making more money when they have maybe no need to make any money, or maybe they're taking too much risk or too little risk because they've never thought about what the objective of it was. The objective of them is just doing it. And, you know, I think that...
Well, lots of times people are told that's what you do.
Well, exactly. All the time they're told. That's why a financial planner can put some perspective and help the person actually define what their goals are.
And actually, you know, I look at my job as helping people live the very best life possible, of the life that they want, not the life that I want. It doesn't matter what my goals are personally. What matters is how do you have, I often say that money is just gasoline in a car. Where are you going? Where do you want to go? You know, what does the chassis look like? You know, money is just the gasoline getting you from point A to point B, wherever that is that your goals take you.
Yeah, it's like the old joke. The good news is we're making great time. The bad news is we're lost.
Or you're going nowhere.
Well, you know, we're going nowhere. So I guess the bottom line is we need a financial planner or a GPS system.
Preferably both.
Preferably both. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Broadview Mortgage. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
Welcome back, everyone. We're in studio today with James Madison, who is a retired banker economics teacher, and a rare bookseller, and so much more. Welcome, James. Thanks for being here with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You didn't mention he was a former president of the United States. he's never heard that joke before.
I'm sure he's never heard it. Well, what's funny is I made that joke yesterday to Neil, and I said, James Madison is coming to speak to us on the radio show from the dead. He didn't even respond. He did not even respond.
Like Milton Berle, I still stole the material.
Yeah, exactly. There was zero. I got nothing back in my text message.
I have friends on both the far right and the far left.
So James, thanks for being here with us today. So let's talk a little bit about how you made your way to Santa Barbara, because you are a Santa Barbara local.
Well, UCSB. I grew up on the UCLA campus. My mother worked there. It was too urban for me. And, I wanted to get out of town and see what the rest of the world was like.
So it's interesting when a young person goes from a big city environment to UCSB, which is fairly rural. And
yes.
Not making a judgment on your age, a little more rural probably when you were there than now even. So what made you stay?
I'm a cyclist, and Santa Barbara, since the mid-60s, has had a thriving bicycle culture. A lot of Olympic and national champions have come out of Santa Barbara. We had frame builders. We had Hazards that had been in business since 1914. It's a great place to ride. It's so scenic.
Yeah, Lance Armstrong's crew is here, too.
Well, yes. Yes, he was indeed. Saw him many times. I did have an interaction with him briefly, and, I can't say it was one of the best interactions I've ever had with a person, but he did a lot for cycling.
So is that because you were riding next to him and he passed you? Is that why
That was the brief interaction.
But, a lot of people have come to train here. The Santa Barbara Bike Club that really came into its own in the late 70s, attracted riders from across the state. And Doug Knox, who owned Hendrickson's, just built it into a very powerful trade team. And with little money, we took on the behemoth, the 7-Eleven team, that had funding from 7-Eleven Corporation.
So why did you go into banking? Because you didn't make it on the Tour de France? By the sounds. But help us weave the path of UCSB cyclists.
Cycling was always just for fun. Coming at it at my age, I didn't have any unrealistic expectations. What I liked about it was a meritocracy. If you put in the miles, you got to ride with the better riders. And that was it. Banking just was happenstance. I worked for GTE, which is now Verizon, and it allowed me, I worked late so I could train in the morning. I was a manager there. I did forecasting for the local GTE division, and I was trying to get into sales after deregulation, but my route was blocked, so I abruptly resigned and went to work for a bike importer. They moved south after a couple of years, and I went to work for E.F. Hutton and Company. I had, my father always said to me, go where the money is. And that seemed to be in the brokerage industry.
Oh, so you started your banking career in the brokerage industry. Now, were you an advisor or what?
Financial consultant.
So you were a financial, NFC back at E.F. Hutton.
Excuse me, I have to question that. In those days, were they called financial consultants?
Well, we had many.
They were called customers men, weren't they? And it was the word men was used.
And there were epithets. We had.
All right, this is going way over my head before my time.
You're showing your age.
But, they always told us in training, you know more than most of the population. So you are a financial consultant. So do your best. And so then, the October 19th, 1987 stock market crash, Hutton ran out of money. They were an OTC, over-the-counter, NASDAQ market maker. So they were the buyer of last resort. Mm. So they went through all their credit lines, and then they merged with Shearson, and I was free. I was let go from my contract. So I went to work for Thompson McKinnon here in Santa Barbara.
But isn't that ironic that Shearson ended up being the place that the chairman of Citibank came from? So there's this little connection there.
Things are interesting.
I think he was following you.
Sandy Weill and you were very close, weren't you?
Yes. And when I was at Fort Meade in Maryland, he was working out of Baltimore, where he had that lending company and built that into a big empire. In the financial industry, you're always meeting people you once worked with.
Now, you know, we got a little ahead of ourselves here in that you worked at a bank, but did you have an economics or business background in college? What did you major in college?
Cultural anthropology.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, that cultural anthropology is really... Well, it is. It's behavioral economics.
What I love about you, Neil, just how quickly these things come out.
Well, that's about where we came from, right?
Right.
We don't know where we are unless we know where we came from, right?
Exactly.
So you went through this merger or buyout from E.F. Hutton and Shearson, and then you
go to work for Thompson McKinnon, and then lo and behold, suddenly Thompson McKinnon runs out of money. They started building their new pink building on somewhere in Manhattan, the day the stock market crashed. So they ran out of money. And so
let's talk a little bit about what your job was then.
Same.
When you first came out.
We used to think of ourselves as financial planners. And some brokers were financial planners. But some were just salespeople that took the hottest stock, called people and said, you got to get on this.
Well, I think that's an important distinction. So most of your work was via the telephone?
Absolutely.
And so you'd call Mr. and Mrs. Smith and say...
Yeah, well, I'd worked for GTE, so I was not afraid to get on the telephone and talk to people. All day. And then you build a book, and I had ethics, and most of my colleagues had ethics, and tried to do what was best for the customer. Find out what their goals are, what their risk level was, and then balance their portfolio, diversify them, and then check in with them every 6 months or so.
So how did you make your way from there to being a private banker at Citigroup?
Well, what happened was, Thompson McKinnon, they went bust. And then,
I think I might have been scared to hire you at this rate.
And then there was a disruption in my private life. And so I went to work for Wells Fargo. I went to – our office was where Saks Fifth Avenue is. That's kind of a – that building is, I think, maybe cursed. And I asked the guy, I said, I want to go to work in banking. And the guy said, see somebody up on Upper State Street. And so that's how I got into banking. And my model was my great uncle that lived in Nashville – was a car dealer, and he had banking relationships. Bankers were very important to fund a large a car dealership. And my car broke down, my Volkswagen, outside of Nashville, and the banker came out in his suit. And I was at a gas station. He talked to the owner of the station, and they took care of me. And I thought, wow, that is really impressive that this guy came out, doesn't know me from Adam, and took care of me. And that was the model in my mind. You take care of your clients. They're your bread and butter. They're your fellow. They live in your community.
Well, I guess you didn't need the fiduciary rule that was just – the fiduciary rule has just gone into effect that may be out of effect after the Republican Congress gets a hold of it where – people need to look at their client, not their own personal interests.
Right,
But I have to say that your view of the world is not what was typical of many brokers.
No.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we're in studio today with James Madison, who's a retired banker and economics teacher, and many other things. Welcome, and thank you for being with us, James.
My pleasure.
So before the break, we were talking about the Department of Labor's fiduciary ruling. And have you read up on what the changes that they're doing on that?
I was reading the New York Times today, yes.
And so how do you think that would have affected your business when you were working in the brokerage firms?
Well, I think initially it would have cut into my commissions. But I always took the long-term view. If you do what's right with your client over time, the business will come. You have to earn trust, and you earn trust by being truthful, transparent, putting the customer's best interest first before your own. I always thought there was a tremendous built-in conflict of interest between the broker and the client. And I did have associations with brokers who, you know, licensed to steal. That joke, you know, was... if you're a policeman and the police get together, observations are made that if we heard them, if we eavesdropped on them, we go, ooh. But brokers, most were very honest and wanted to do the right thing. And I figured, I'm a long-term resident of this community. I respect this community. I'm going to see them at the grocery store. They might even be on a bicycle ride with me. I'm not going to do anything to damage that relationship.
Well, I think that that's a great way to look at it because, you know, all we have really is our reputation. And
that's right.
If you don't do what's right for people, it's very hard to earn back your reputation.
Absolutely.
So I think you took the right course of action. So what brought you to Citibank? So
well,
you went
that was
to Wells.
I left Wells. There was a merger when they merged with First Interstate, and they were letting people
Well, hey, that's a step up. It wasn't a going out of business situation.
No, not this time. So I swapped with a guy who had been – they offered him a package, and I said, well, wait a minute. I'll take that package because I wanted to build my book business. And I was tired of the Wells Fargo management style at the time. And he swapped with me, and I got management to approve it. So I was out of banking and working in my book business for 6 years, and it was a wonderful holiday. I put it to good use. And then after the 9/11 attacks, there was a need for older people in the branches of the banks, and I got calls from three banks almost simultaneously, within a week.
Why did they want older people?
Well, people were freaked out. They didn't want some, and I'm not being critical of younger people. They wanted someone older, maybe with grayer hair, to say, hey, everything's going to be all right. Mm. Remember the markets? There was a huge decline in the markets.
Yeah, 43%. I remember.
Yeah. So,
I have a great memory.
Yeah.
Yes, another great time, a great moment in time here.
Right. Yeah, sometimes we don't see as people in the financial industry, or if you're so far in the subculture, those ripples have a huge effect.
Oh, an absolute huge effect. I remember I had a client who has since passed away. She called me up the day that trading resumed and said, I want to put all this money, all this cash in the market because I want to do what's good for America.
Right, yeah.
But she was the exception, certainly not the rule.
Well, that was Buffett's advice, right? Warren Buffett had a lot of credibility. Invest in America. Get back in the market.
So let's,
and that would have been a good
it would
for
have
four
paid
or five
off.
Years anyway.
No, it paid off, it, you know,
long
once
term.
You were in long term for sure.
Right.
So as for our listeners that are wondering, what exactly does a private banker do? How does that differ from a financial advisor, from the teller, from all the people sitting in the cubes as you walk into the bank?
A private banker, a personal banking officer, a financial consultant. They kept changing the names. It's someone who cultivates a long-term relationship, so you have more time to develop a relationship. It's not you come in, you open an account, you spend 5 minutes with them, take the check, you put it in their account, and you're out. Sorry. You have time, and you build that relationship over time, and you're functioning without the certification of a financial planner. That's how I saw it. So I would ask all kinds of questions. You know, what are your hobbies? What interests you? What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And I got to know a lot of my clients. And yes, there was an ulterior motive, but I enjoyed the process. And I just like getting to know people. They're in my community. I want to know what's going on. So my curiosity led me.
But is there a difference? I know some banks, the private banker does the intake, put it, you know, in a very, you know, limited way. And then the actual work or portfolio construction is done by other people.
Right.
So that if that's the same model that you used, did that separate you from the clients, or were you always there for?
I resisted that. That was always changing. They're always trying to come up with a new formula. And ironically, the goal of that formula was to secure a deeper relationship with a client as they were moving the person they were interacting with further and further away. And we had these different levels. I just resisted all that. And there was a lot of conflict with that because, you know, some people have certain responsibility. Say a $5 million loan, I wasn't part of that. But I'm the person that hands off. This is a customer. They want this loan. And sometimes you get attitude like, hey, this is not your turf. You know, it's like being a policeman on patrol, and then there's a homicide, the detectives come in, and you leave. Well, I always wanted to be part of, continuing to be part of the process, because after that loan goes through, who's going to get the call? An 800 number? No, they're going to call me. What's going on? So the banks are still doing it. I still have friends. There's still constant reorganization to get closer to the client. Just let somebody in the branch do their job, make the relationship work.
So you also teach economics. What drew you to teaching?
Well, I had great teachers in, I went through the LA City school system. I had great teachers, all those fabulous women teachers in the 50s. You know, if you weren't an actress or married to a wealthy man, there was all that talent going to waste, and a lot of them went into teaching. And as kids in grammar school and junior high and high school, we had the benefit of their intelligence. So then it always inspired me. And I have a friend up in Monterey. She's 92, owns a bookstore. She's still in touch with many of her former clients. They can really inspire you and help you see a pathway.
But teaching economics, didn't that require some academic preparation, not just being an online banker? But how did you become conversant in economics from an academic standpoint?
Well, I got some training through E.F. Hutton, and then I was a banker, and I was shocked that a lot of my banker friends were not reading anything about banking. You know, they didn't even know really what the Fed did. Mm-hmm. And so I have a book business. I buy books. I just bought books on economics and started reading them, you know, from whether they're on a Hayek type or a liberal economist like Galbraith, and just started amassing the information inside my mind.
The irony of it is that over the years, economics has, you know, has gone from the dismal science to actually very critical in as to making investment decisions.
Even broader decisions than just your investment decisions, business decisions. Definitely, the economic sciences have gained in stature.
Right. And I am a great proponent of it, but I have to say, a lot of it is still dismal. On that happy note, you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hey.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. So, James, you are a long-term resident. Have you graced the tables of Arnaldi's Cafe over the years?
And played some bocce, perhaps?
Absolutely. Two of my friends have bocce courts.
Wow.
Yes, I'm a mediocre bocce player, but I'm aggressive. Not afraid to roll the ball, give it some speed, some English. And yes, Charlene and I, my wife, we do find ourselves at Arnaldi's.
Well, just to be careful now, because Diane is always is ranked as number one bocce player in Santa Barbara.
Well, not me. My team is number one on Monday nights.
That's a little, is that different?
Oh.
Yes, Monday night. We're the champions of the Monday night.
Oh. Are they open Monday nights?
They are. But that would be a good one, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I didn't know I was in the company of a highly rated
bocce player. Yes.
You know what we do? After the show, we always go to Arnaldi's and we have a bocce playoff for the guests. So, you know, now we have a problem because he actually knows how to play.
I know. We're not going to be able to win.
Well,
no,
I know how to roll a ball in the dirt. But if I may, I do want to expand on one thing you said earlier before the break about the importance of the economy. So, you know, we had panics in this country, in our economy, before the rise of the Fed. And, you know, the panic of 1873, the panic in 1907.
You look terrific for someone that remembers them.
But these were huge events. And after all these panics, boom and bust, there was a populist uprising. And those uprising shaped our politics. And so the financial collapse, that's what I call it, 2007, 2008, 2009, you know, had a huge, huge impact. And
I think
hurt.
You're right. And what's interesting is it's also shaping the minds of the millennials, so many of whom were too young to actually play a role in it, per se. But they are the most conservative group out there is this millennial. They're more conservative than the 70 and 80-year-olds.
Yes.
And I think it will have lasting ramifications unless they get some serious education, because they won't have that compounding interest to help them grow their money and lead to retirement, especially as the traditional pensions are more and more a thing of the past.
That's a good point. The some of the younger people I work with, they're trying to avoid student debt. I went to UCSB on the GI Bill, and it wasn't a big GI Bill like the one after World War II, but a lot of millennials have student debt.
Oh, they have hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt. So who are your students in your econ classes?
High school seniors in the ROP program, Regional Occupational Program at San Marcos High School. It's a virtual business enterprise class. So these are students that want to start their own business. So they form a corporation. So there's a CEO and a COO and a CFO and head of marketing and head of HR. And they get some idea, and they work with software, Excel. You know, how do you run a business? How do you market your product? How do you come up with a product? And my role was, through Junior Achievement that the banks used to work with, there's a textbook that takes us through the basic economic principles from free enterprise, the law of demand and supply, all the way through last three chapters on global trade. And I just explained to them, all right, what is this? Why is this important? Psychological wants, human needs. You know, we need food, shelter, clothing, psychological wants. I want a Ferrari. I want to live like Beyonce. All right, that's great. How do you get there? What does it take? What's your place in the economy? You know, you embrace technology, but will technology embrace you, depending on the path you choose? So
So when you see your students, do they confirm that millennial kind of overreaction to the 2008 crisis in terms of their viewpoint on stocks and bonds?
No. And I discourage, I see my role as encouraging them. They see the future, many of them, and they, all right, I can't wait to get out there, live on my own, follow my dream, make it happen. And what I try to communicate is, if you have an interest, a passion, a particular skill, you know, drawing, whatever, you know, follow that out. It may lead you into your place in the economy. It may be very, very beneficial. I try to foster optimism. You're going to have to work at it. You're going to have failure. Failure is going to be instructive. You have to keep moving forward. I see it. These are 17-year-old Americans. And the worst thing I could do would be to discourage them in any way. I try to be realistic.
Oh, that's great to hear that they're optimistic. And do they seem overly aggressive? Do you do that? Do you play kind of a stock market game with them? And in terms of, I know that's what I did in my senior year of college or high school's econ classes. You know, you get to pick stocks and bonds and see and monitor and see how your fake
money.
Yeah,
we do have that. We do have that. That's something that they started with their teacher. What they are aggressive about is using their cell phones and being online, being, you know, fixated on their phones constantly. I think that's an issue.
It's an issue, by the way, for investors too. In fact, an article we looked at last week was about having some person is developing an app, which if you look at the stock market too often, it will stop you. Because the better investor, the Warren Buffett type investor, doesn't micromanage their own portfolio because you make emotional decisions.
Right.
So it's not only a bad thing just as socially being, you know, attached to your cell phone. By looking at the stock market constantly, you end up being a worse investor.
Absolutely. Looking at anything too much, you know, it clouds your judgment.
Yeah, that's why I don't look in the mirror anymore as I've gotten older.
So tell us about your book business. Do you have a brick and mortar?
No brick and mortar. I have a specialty book business that wouldn't support a brick and mortar. And, I mean, I think that's being borne out by current events. But I deal in, believe it or not, vintage paperbacks. And those are paperbacks that were produced from 1940 to the mid to late 60s. There is a market for it, for them, and I'm happy to say a growing market. More women are coming in to the hobby or whatever it is. The cover art is, the illustrations are compelling to me. People collect them. They might collect a certain type of genre.
So how do you go about dealing in the books if you do not have a brick and mortar?
Well, I used to do book fairs. Before the rise of the internet, we, say 200 book dealers would get together on a weekend, and hundreds, if not, you know, maybe 1,000, 1,500 people would line up, and they'd flood the conference area, and you'd sell books for 2.5 days, and it was fun. In that situation, people brought their specialties. So instead of going, you know, I'll go to Hollywood, I'll go to Beverly Hills, and I'll go to Monrovia, you could get 200 book dealers in a big conference hall and
so
get
now,
a lot of your needs satisfied.
With the rise of the internet, do you sell them on eBay? How do you go about
I did sell them on eBay before the financial collapse, and then the asset prices got so low and people were so tight for money that I went off eBay. I didn't want to sell my products for what I thought was a bad use of my time. So I just withdrew from the market and just went to a couple of shows per year just to keep my relationships alive with – I have a lot of buyers that have stayed with me.
So you still do actually the book shows today?
I do two a year, and it's enough. I thought when
are they well attended?
Yes, they are, and it's growing. That's why, you know, there are people coming into it, and younger people. You know, the problem with the book business, I used to look, wow, you know, we're really graying. Where are the new customers? And in the vintage paperback business, younger people are coming in.
I think that even translates to the public library, and the use of the public library has gone up tenfold. And some people were thinking that it was going to become obsolete.
You know, it's one of the interesting things is kids sometimes don't know what a 78 record is. At least now they'll always know what a book is because they don't have to just listen to it on read a book on their iPad. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we have in studio with us today James Madison, who's a bit of a jack of all trades, has a very diverse career path. And so today, you also work at Trader Joe's, right?
I do. And I enjoy it very much.
Tell us why it's so rewarding.
Well, it's just like banking. The relationships I have with my crew members, young and old, male, female, and the customers, many of which are former banking clients from all the different subcultures I've been in. It's just a continuous source of joy. And a place like Trader Joe's, any place in the city where people mingle, all types of people, not just one subculture, I think is valuable for our city and our state and our country. And that's what I enjoy about it.
And so you think Trader Joe's provides that outlet for people?
I think the ambience... the way you feel inside there is not an accident. It's a care that the company, I don't speak for the company on this, what my experience has been, it's real. And our customers make it real. The crew makes it real.
Well, my kids love it because whenever they say, oh, I want to taste those ice cream cones, you all open up the package.
You know what's interesting about business and the general, you know, perception that you have to cut costs. Look at look at Starbucks, and then look at Trader Joe's, who provide an environment, benefits that aren't typical of corporations. They have the best consumer satisfaction. A year ago, Walmart was in real trouble. And they decided to do something radical. They decided to raise salaries and to get a clearer track for advancement. And guess what? Their costs went up, but their profit margins went up too because the employees were serving their customers better. So, you know, it sounds counterintuitive to listening to all of the economic rhetoric today about cost cutting and profit margins. But ironically, if you are and true for the stock market as well, if you're serving your customer in a way that makes the customer feel good, you're going to end up with a better loyalty from that customer.
Well, and absolutely. I also think with the fall of the brick and mortar store, that becomes even more valuable because people do not have an outlet if your only shopping experience is online to have that interaction, which makes it more valuable, which makes it more important to treat your employees the way you want them to treat your customers.
Going forward, where are we going to interact as Americans?
Well, you know, Levittown, which was this first big development in Long Island, what they did, they changed the paradigm. Everyone used to have a porch that looked out in the street.
Yeah.
They turned the house around so the backyard was the porch. So
the it
was a really fundamental change in how Americans interacted with their neighbors. And when I moved here, it took me 2 years to meet my next door neighbor because everyone had a wall and a gate.
Right.
And it just so happens I went out to get the mail the same time my neighbor did, and I was able to say hello. Anyway, it's great to meet you again, James. And we're going to have you back when you have five new careers. And we can continue to talk and talk. You've been listening to Money Talk, and we'll be back here next week at the same time.